Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with soon-to-be 93-year-old Ed Hall of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from South Carolina. And on December 7th, 1941, an 18-year-old at Oahu's Hickam Field, adjacent to Pearl Harbor. When we left off, Ed told us about being in a mess hall there and hearing an explosion unlike anything he had ever heard before. Once he went outside, he would be seeing things he never would have imagined.
I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue. Hangar 7 and 9 had blown up and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire. And this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. But he had to pull up to miss the building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was. And I could see him. So then I went running out, hollering for Alex, "Where is everybody?" Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided, I got to hide someplace. Oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. And things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out, started yelling for Alex. And I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air, looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, curse me out, you're going to get killed, get under here. And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the heck with the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, it always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, "Stop, stop, I need you, I need you." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm a medic, we got wounded. We got to get him to the hospital." So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a .45 automatic. I figured, well, his guts are spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his .45 and never cleaned that belt either. Still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck, and we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab that just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat. Not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out, went to shut the door, he says, "My God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof." And I looked at it, my Lord, where did it? And then I realized the tires had been shot out, and these dang gun bullets came through the roof of the cab, number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the The next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron. The rest of my tour during the war was spent in Air Corps Supply. I transferred to Air Corps Supply, and I spent the rest of the war as a supply person throughout the Pacific. So that's about the extent of December the 7th, 41.
Well, I've got a few questions to ask you about all that, and I think a lot of people can feel and understand a little more of what it must have been like from hearing your description. But I'm curious, that first moment, I mean, you described hearing those explosions while you're in the mess hall, but then when you come out and you see an airplane and it's coming right at you and you see these explosions and this debris flying all around, what did you think was happening? Because nobody knows a war is coming. I mean, had you even considered the possibility that someone could attack you there on Hawaii?
Not at all. It was the furthest thing from our minds. That was the most surprising and devastating day I've ever spent in my life. People just don't realize the feeling that you have, which is actually no feeling at the very moment that is happening. And then all of a sudden it dawns on you. Then it doesn't fully hit you until, like it didn't really hit me until about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon after the attack was all over with. And I realized what I had done in picking up wounded and the dead as to how devastating this attack was. Now, there was another thing that I saw, and I didn't know at the time. From where we were, as I said, the edge of the building was shut off the roof. At that point, as I ran out, I saw this huge explosion from Pearl Harbor. I didn't know it then, but that was the Arizona exploding. See, this all happened. Everything that I'm telling you happened in less than 10 minutes. It didn't take very long, believe me. It all happened so fast. And then, of course, the explosion of the Shaw was another one. I could see the smoke, and I heard the explosion. But I didn't know what had happened at Pearl. But I found out later that was the Arizona. Oh, by the way, speaking of the Arizona, there's one thing a lot of people may not know, that there is 1,177 sailors still in that ship. They were never recovered simply because there was too much going on for the next few days. Preparing defenses, trying to repair ships that could be repaired. The powers that be thought the bodies were secondary. Don't worry about it. Do it later. But then after a while, they decided they would just leave the bodies there as a memorial, and that's what happened. Of course, now I think everybody knows that today, any survivor of the Arizona who passes away can have his ashes reburied in the Arizona if he so desires. A lot of people don't know that.
Well, and I want to hear eventually about your experiences going back there and visiting the Arizona and Hickam Field and everything there. But back on December 7th, I'm just trying to get a feel for this. So you're 18 years old. Your world has just changed. The whole world has just changed. But you mentioned it, no feeling, that sense of shock and some kind of numbness that you can't feel. It's so extreme that you can't even feel it at first. So you're going. You're driving this truck. You're picking up dead bodies. You're picking up the wounded. How far was that trip to the hospital from where you were?
Anywhere from 4 to about 6 or 7 blocks.
And as you make these trips back and forth, does it ever strike you that you're putting yourself in danger by doing that?
No, I never thought about that. All I thought about was trying to get help to people. I never even thought about the risk that I might be taking. Cecil Jacobs and we just couldn't understand what was happening, really, and we were too scared to be scared, if you follow what I mean. We just did what we thought we had to do, people that needed help.
I guess when you get out of the truck and you see the tires are shot out and then there's bullets in the cab between where the two of you are sitting, it kind of hits home that that you were in danger. But when did you grasp the magnitude of what happened, the scope of what happened, and the reality that this is war?
Oh, that must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon when things did calm down somewhat. I mean, the attack was over and all of that. The attack actually was over about, 10:20, 10:30? The second wave finished and they left.
But you guys don't know that. It's not like they gave you a signal, said, hey, it's over now. You don't know if anything else is coming.
No, we didn't know. We didn't know. We were still anticipating. Every time a plane, even ours, would fly over, we know, oh, God, here they come again. And, of course, you know, we shot down, I believe it was 6 of our own planes that night, and that was a scary thing. We thought it was going to be an invasion now. It was a very scary time. Once you realized what had happened and your thoughts got together and you realized, my God, we're at war, we've been attacked, I was damn near killed. Oh, my God, what else is going to happen? Are they coming back again? It was a frightening situation, especially that night.
And can you paint a picture for us of, just at Hickam Field, the devastation that occurred there and the contrast between what Hickam looked like before the attack and in the aftermath?
Well, Hickam Field was one of the most beautiful bases I have ever seen in my life. It was new. It wasn't even completed yet. Now, I'm guessing. I really don't know. But from what I remember, that base was about 70% complete. There were supposed to be 20 hangars, and there was 3 and 5. Why there were 3 and 5, I've never been able to find out. There was 3 and 5, 7 and 9, 11 and 13, 15 and 17, and that was on the west end of the base, or the west half. And on the eastern half, the mountainside half, there was supposed to be hangars, and there was number 2 and number 4. Then there was supposed to be 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, and 20. I may be wrong on the numbers, but anyway, I know there was hangars 2 and 4, and there was supposed to be more. Then we had the million-dollar barracks, they called it, because it did cost just a little over $1 million to build that beautiful building. There was 9 wings, 3 stories high, and those barracks were absolutely devastated. They were bombed and strafed, and the marks are still in the building. They'll never be repaired. They're preserved there, too, as a remembrance of December the 7th, 41. And that building was so badly damaged that they could only reuse, if my memory serves me right, the first 2 floors. The top floors were, for the most part, were rendered useless. But that was one beautiful building. Then you had in front of that building the most beautiful parade ground. And that parade ground ran toward Pearl Harbor. And there was a main street. Then there was the headquarters building. And on the other side of the headquarters building, still going toward Pearl Harbor, was another beautiful parade ground. It was one beautiful build, beautiful, beautiful base. And I went back. I'm not sure what year it was that they turned that beautiful parade ground in front of the building, turned it into a parking lot. That broke my heart. That broke my heart. That was such a beautiful area.
Well, I think the first to mess with that beauty and disrupt that peace would have been the Japanese that morning. And so you're looking at all this and you see destroyed hangars, shot up runways, the barracks decimated. What does that do to you and your fellow airmen emotionally to see that, to witness that?
Mostly it made us all mad as hell. Oh, the cursing that went on, and oh man, we really had a field day cursing those people. To me, I wouldn't buy a Japanese car on a bet. I'm still American-made, man, and I just can't understand people buying all these foreign cars. And I hope you're not driving one.
I'll plead the 5th right now. Don't want this interview to end just yet. So you've seen what happened at Hickam, and you mentioned, without knowing what it was, you saw the explosion of the Arizona. and then that magazine just blowing everything in the air on the Shaw. At what point did you actually see the aftermath of what had happened there next door at Pearl Harbor?
Oh, that took a while because we were busy in our own place there trying to get things squared away. And I just can't tell you. Our trucking company, we worked our butts off. As a matter of fact, it was 3.5 days before I ever got into a bed. I caught naps in the trucks while they were loading, unloading, or whatever. I'd catch a little nap. But it had to be at least 3 days before I ever crawled into a bed itself.
And what were you guys doing that whole time?
Mostly cleaning up. For instance, now we had to move all of the food that was salvageable from the big mess hall. Oh, by the way, there's something interesting. There was a mess hall. The dining area was so big, you could have actually put 6 basketball courts in it. And it was devastated. It was ruined. There was 14 people killed in the mess hall. 8 of them were cooks that had ran into a walk-in refrigerator for protection, and it was a victim of a direct hit, and concussion killed them. They had no wounds on them, just the concussion killed them. And that kitchen and that whole mess hall was just absolutely devastated. Couldn't use it anymore. As a matter of fact, they made a gymnasium out of it.
We need to take our last break, but we'll get the rest of Ed's December 7th story when we get back, plus what trips back to Pearl Harbor and to Washington, D.C. and the World War II Memorial have meant to him. Find his smiling face at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country. And proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, it is hard to forget the story of Jimmy Weldon. Or, as so many of us first heard him, the voice of that little duck on the Yogi Bear show, Yakky Doodle.
Help! Chopper! Chopper, you're after me!
Run, little feller!
I'm running!
Yakky, now that you're safe, tell me. Where's your mama?
I don't have no mama. Would you be my mama?
Yep, even in his 90s, he can still do that voice. And you can see and hear for yourself at a special lunch with Jimmy Weldon on Thursday, October 20th in Clovis, California. Maybe you grew up with Uncle Jimmy Weldon and Webster Webfoot on TV in places like Bakersfield, Monterey, Salinas, or Fresno. You'll be amazed at his journey from World War II in Europe all the way to Hollywood and everywhere in between. And you'll be moved by just how much he loves our country. Thursday, October 20th from noon to 1:30 at the Clovis Veterans Memorial District building, a lunch you'll never forget with the one and only Jimmy Weldon. For tickets, go to cbmcfresno.com or call 559-225-5095. That number again, 559-225-5095. I'll be there, and I hope to see you there, October 20th in Clovis.